You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
So I had this meal, which for me, I think, is still to this day the meal by which all others are measured. It was perfect. I mean, when I say it was perfect, I couldn't fault a single element. There was not one thing that I went, you know. So when we do scoring for actual cooking competitions, basically everyone starts with 100 points. So you've got 100 points to begin with. And every time you find a fault, you then take points off. So no one ever gets 100.
That's both a magical answer and also a deeply disappointing one, because you have, of course, dined at my house and on one particular occasion with David Higgs,
yes.
Where I cooked for the both of you. And it does now, when I asked you if you could score the meal and you gave me a big thumbs up and said 10, I was quite excited. I now realise you'd found 90 things wrong with the food I made for you.
Hooray!
If you are listening to The Dan Nichols Show in its early days, reborn as this brand new media explosion that is the podcast, you might be doing so having watched The Dan Nichols Show on Supersport for many years. And if you go back to the very, very first episode, and this is kind of black and white television and the guy playing the piano in your living room as people moved awkwardly across the screen, the very first episode featured quite an interesting collection of characters. There was an elderly footballer, an even older rugby player, and then a young up-and-coming chef who looked kind of like what Rory McIlroy might have looked like if he'd shaved his head and aged a little and not really looked after himself terribly well in the kitchen, which would bring you to my very special guest today. He's not just someone I've worked with for many years, but he's one of my very best mates. Pete Goffwood, welcome.
Good morning, Dan.
I'm trying to remember, in fact, I was doing so as I wove my way through traffic this morning. Our first encounter was at the old Good Food and Wine Show,
yes.
Where I stood about 35 deep, hoping to get up and you'd just kind of touch you because that was your status in the culinary world. And then being incredibly surprised when you looked up over the shoulders of kind of 35 Constantia housewives who were beaming at you and mentally undressing you with their eyes and said hello. And it turned out that you had not only realized but read a review I'd written of your fabulous Kitchen Cowboys book, and that kicked off our very first introduction.
It did indeed, yes. I remember because we had met briefly, very briefly before then, on the radio. I was a guest on John Matham's show, and you were doing the sport at the time.
I was, yes. Very badly.
Yes. So it was great. It was a brilliant review as I remember it correctly. It was a great book. That would have been 2003, in fact.
Yep, that's
yes,
right.
When Kitchen Cowboys came out.
I was just out of 44 years of doing almost nothing at UCT for a Bachelor of Arts in English. Do it, kids. It'll put you into teaching or waiting tables. And it was a great book for me. This is before you became this television superstar.
Yes.
But you're still very much a star of the cooking world. And most people who produced cookbooks at that time, it was how cool and lavish and complicated and full of amazing photos can I make it? And this was the first one I'd read where I understood about 70% of the ingredients. And
yeah.
I didn't need to kit out my kitchen with a German import just to be able to make a starter.
Yeah, look, I think that was always the point of the exercise. It was directed at men to get men into the kitchen to cook. And I think that's always the problem. My problem always has been with cookbooks is you look at something, you think, okay, I need to. Find a tree in the middle of the desert that only blossoms once every 7 years to get some of these and to take a bit of bark to go in my stew. And I wanted a book that was accessible so that, you know, you could literally stop at the supermarket on the way home and have dinner on the table by 8 o'clock. And for me, that was all. It was the same with when I used to do demonstrations, or still when I do demonstrations. I hate that kind of, oh, here's one we made earlier. You know, if I've got a 45-minute demonstration to do, then I'll make something that I can make from scratch in 45 minutes, because I find that is what people find accessible. You know, it's not, you know, I'm just going to add this jus that's been reducing for 15 hours, you know, after roasting, you know, 30 kilos of veal bones. And people just switch off to that. You know, they go, oh, okay, that looks all very interesting, but I could never make that. I like to, the books and the recipes that I write are aimed at getting people to have a go. And we go, there's no mystery of risotto anymore. I've just seen him make it. I can go, we'll give that a whirl when we get home, you know. And I know that the local spa's got all of those ingredients. So that's always kind of been my ethos when it comes to recipes and books, is to make them accessible, but that the book itself will actually be useful.
Because this is going to horrify some people, but you don't every single night for dinner have a 7-course souffle-based tasting menu. You do sometimes stop at the Engine Orange Street garage and grab a pie and a packet of salt and vinegar crisps.
Oh yeah, most definitely. It's always quite.
Evenings, actually.
Yeah, most evenings. I remember many years ago, I used to live in Franschhoek, and in Franschhoek, there's not a great deal to do. Entertainment-wise, unless you're going to eat in a restaurant. And so there was a huge swathe of chefs. When I think back then, you know, Richard Carstens, Ruben Riffel, Marco Janser, and the like, Matthew Gordon. So if you were off of an evening and you fancied having someone around for dinner, it was a case of if you weren't working, you were up for it. And I remember having this discussion with a magazine editor. And they were all fascinated about, so if Ruben and Marco come around for dinner, what do you guys have? And I go, what do you mean? What's on the menu? I said, well, more often than not, roast chicken. And they went, and? I go, well, roast chicken, and maybe someone will bring a piece of cheese or a loaf of bread, and we'll, a salad, maybe some roasted vegetables. And everyone was kind of completely under-awed.
This is shattering the illusion.
Yeah, that you know, we didn't each do several courses. And I said, you know, the food is merely a mechanism. You know, obviously it's a free-range chicken. It's probably roasted, but it was more about sitting around the table. There's that conviviality of the table. What we ate was immaterial. And I think some people forget that as chefs I mean, my favorite, my mate George Jardine, we have long, long lunches. Don't ever ask me to remember what any of the dishes were or what food we ate. I can tell you what wine we drank, but very seldom can I remember what food we ate.
This interest in food that we have as non-professional chefs has gone through the roof the last 10, 15 years, and big part of that has been food on television. And you, in turn, have been a big part of that. I again remember you calling me, swearing me to secrecy, because you'd got this new gig, because you're doing this show called MasterChef. And I seem to remember nodding and pretending to know what that was, and then going to have to furiously Google on my ADSL line and find out all the details. That became a huge thing, because you went from pretty well known in the food industry to, I think your famous line was, you could no longer go to the shops in your pajamas on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, look, I think MasterChef, that was definitely a game changer. You know, it was it just opened up a whole world that hitherto had been out of my reach. You know, you say I had a fairly decent following in the food fraternity, but television, both MasterChef and now Ultimate Braai Master, just changed the dynamics of it completely. I mean, it's just one of those things. My favorite story still is myself and my Earthwell sidekick, Benny Massick-Gwemeng, who we were both judges on MasterChef and now on Ultimate Braai Master. We were on the road shooting Braai Master, and we were in Kroonstad, and we stopped at a Checkers, and we wanted to get a couple of Red Bulls and some popcorn, a couple of pies and some crisps.
Standard chef fare for
popcorns. And within about 3 or 4 minutes of walking around the supermarket, we were aware that we were being followed. And it was almost like one of these kind of Benny Hill moments where you turn around suddenly and everyone kind of stops and looks away, ducks back behind a shelf or something. And eventually someone came up to us, a young girl came up to us and said, oh, are you the guys from TV? And we said, yes. She, oh, is it okay if I can we take a picture? So we said, yeah, of course. I mean, it's standard fare. You know, you've always got time for that kind of thing. And within seconds, there was a queue a mile long. And we ended up spending about an hour and a half in the supermarket. And I think we took pictures with every single person in the supermarket. The best was the guys from the butchery all came tumbling out. And the guy who could see he was in charge, he started screaming and shouting. And they all disappeared. And they came back and they'd all got clean aprons on. So, yeah, it's become that. It's, you know, it's... it's one of those things, you know. It's if you want to be on television, you realize, I mean, you yourself know, you become public property to a large degree. You know, people come up to you and they want to say how's it and they want to take pictures, and it's just part of the job. It doesn't bother me at all, actually. I quite enjoy it. I mean, it's one of those egotistical things. You know, you've got people coming up to you every day and saying they love what you do. I mean, who hates that?
Yeah. You know? And mine are normally just telling me to please stop and can you finally end that show. That's usually my mum, and she's been drinking again.
Yeah.
You got to do all this, and you got to not just have a great time with bumping into people, but also with people on the show. And you convinced a lot of people, and unfortunately some of them are my friends and I have to go and eat at their houses. You convinced people who can't cook that they can. So not everything you did was good, Pete. But the majority of it was, when you went through that show, the dishes you get to eat, you've got to judge food made by people who haven't cooked for a living.
Yeah.
And mostly I think they looked as though they kind of knew what they were doing. Were there a couple? Were there some dishes along the way where still you wake up in a cold sweat 3 a.m, oh my God, that was awful?
Yes. There were a number of dishes like that. And I think, you know, the thing about MasterChef and also to a large degree Prime Master is because you're dealing with amateurs. Even the talented and experienced amateurs, you know, when it goes wrong, it goes horribly wrong. And I think that's often what happens is the difference between the amateurs and the professionals is the professionals understand when something's gone wrong and how to fix it. The problem with amateurs is once it just this downward spiral that just goes... It
keep
just,
digging that calorie hole.
Exactly. Some of the dishes, the one that always springs to mind for me during MasterChef wasn't actually badly made. It was just badly presented. We'd sent contestants out to various places around Cape Town to look for traditional South African food, chicken and sago pie and pickled fish and briedi and all sorts of bits and pieces. And one of the dishes was tripe. And so what they had to do is they had to bring the dish that they tasted, and they had to replicate it. They didn't have to make a better version of it, but they had to just replicate the dish. And it was a challenge that was shot over 2 days. And when we were tasting the tripe, we were as usual story with tea, we were behind schedule, and so we had to speed everything up. And one of the speeding up versions was they didn't reheat the tripe that the guys had bought with for the bait. And so we were sitting there and the other judges know my not a version for tripe, but it's not high on my list of my favorite things. And I got, of course, then I got to go first. And it had this kind of congealed fat layer on the top, you know.
My breakfast is coming up.
Yeah, and tripe doesn't smell fabulous at the best of times. And when it's cold, it really is quite nasty. And I had to put this thing in my mouth, and I was chewing. And eventually I was like a hamster with it stuck in my cheek because I knew that if I swallowed it, we'd all see it again. And the guys were going, Pete, right? I was going, thumbs up. And I sat there for 10 minutes just nodding and going, and we had to wait before we could cut so I could spit it out. It was one of those memorable dishes.
A mouthful of cold, pungent tripe.
Oh, it was nasty. Pretty, pretty nasty.
Oh, what did the poor contestant think of it?
Yeah, they were kind of, they could see my discomfort. It was, well, everyone could see my discomfort. This was what was annoying about it, was that I'd clearly been set up to take the fall, and the other guys were going, so Pete, and they're trying to get comments out of me, knowing that how uncomfortable it was.
They're just loving it as you're hating
every moment
it.
Of it, yeah.
Oh, of course, the contestants are just desperately hoping to get your adulation, to get your thumbs up. Does that extend to generally? And I remember from the times that we've hung out together, we were out at a restaurant in the Winelands. I won't mention it because they got something wrong. But we had I think there were 20 of us. 19 of the dishes came 7-star Michelin.
Yeah.
And then they brought out your fish. And I think it had been caught a week before, and it was cold, and it was just awful. And I remember watching the face drain from the color of the poor waitress, as you explained. So not in a nasty way.
Yeah.
You didn't get up and shout and throw things, but in a very cold Bond villain voice, you told her that, I think your exact words were, this is unimpressive. We were all trying to keep a straight face, and you weren't. It wasn't you were reveling in it. You were just disappointed that you hadn't got a good meal. But that restaurant, I think they fired the entire team within minutes.
It's entirely possible. Look, I, you know, for me, it's one of those things. I always urge people to complain in restaurants. You know, you're parting with hard-earned cash, and if it's not right, it's not right. You know, and the other thing, and the reason I say you complain is because restaurants would rather you complained and sorted out your complaint than leave unhappy. I think therein lies, and South Africans can be a little bit like that, that they don't want to make a fuss.
Until they get onto Twitter and
yeah, of course, then they go berserk. But it's just one of those, so, and, oh, I won't go back there. And I think that's therein lies the problem for restaurants. They could have fixed it if you'd said something, because it happens. You know, people overcook something, or someone puts too much salt in it, or accidents, mistakes do happen in restaurants. There's no question about that. And given the restaurant the chance to rectify it, is often led to great relationships with regular customers who then come back because there's an element of they've been listened to and it's been sorted out. You know, obviously how you handle a complaint for me is always a mark of a good restaurant, is how they deal with that complaint. You know, there's someone, we've had one before, restaurant in Clove Street many, many years ago. And it was a duck dish. It was a duck confit. And this duck, clearly, he'd been, I don't know, they'd found it under a fridge or it'd fallen down, because it was like old shoe leather that was really, really bad. And the manager of the restaurant actually came to the table to argue. And he said he didn't accept it because it's one of the most popular dishes. And it wasn't my dish. It was someone else on the table. And in fact, we'd actually come from the Good Food and Wine Show, and there were like three journalists and two other chefs. And of course, his manager didn't realize who he was talking to. And he literally stood leaning on the table, kind of a very aggressive stance. And we just looked at him and thought, dude. And then one of the journalists actually said to him, he said, you know, you have just ruined this evening. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, we can forgive bad food. It happens. He said, but your aggressive attitude has ruined this evening. And it was interesting because I knew the chef who wasn't on duty that night. And I got this phone call actually from the manager to apologize the next day. He'd clearly been, because we all left cards. We said, well, tell Paula that we were all, we gave them to the waiter, just make sure she gets them. And of course, the dude got, yeah, and it didn't end pretty for him.
What about the worry that if you do say, you know what, they've overdone my steak, or this fish is inedible, and I send it back, that it does come back, but it comes back with lashings of kitchen saliva. Is that just a...
No, it's, you know, everyone seems to think that that's the case. I've in 35 years as a professional chef, I've never witnessed that in any kitchen ever.
Can you look me in the eye and say you've never once spat on a dish you send me?
On yours, okay.
That's the exception.
Yeah, and then that's not even when you complain; just when you come in,
it adds a salinity to the dish. Yeah, I'm not really complaining.
No, look, I think that's, there's always that fear that, you know, chefs hate people who complain. You know, if someone sends out a well done steak and you didn't order it well done, we'll do it again without a question. And as I said, our chance to rectify it means that's how we guarantee your repeat business. So this business of the chefs taking umbrage and spitting in the food and what have you, it's an old fishwife tale that very seldom, if ever, happens. As I've never witnessed it.
Of course, you're talking often in the past tense here, because the life of celebrity superstar chef Pete Goffwood, if I look at your Instagram page, it's mostly lying on beaches in Mozambique. It's hanging out the occasional glamorous dinner where you do absolutely no work and everybody else runs around at your discretion. Or you're on set with television shows where you kind of leave your jacuzzi to go and grudgingly do a link here or there. How much time do you actually get to spend in a kitchen, and do you miss being in a kitchen more regularly?
Yes, I do. Actually, it's and part of it's not necessarily the cooking. It's almost like it's that camaraderie. You know, it's sportsmen will often tell you that after they've retired, it's not they miss playing football, but they miss being in the change room after a game, having won and that kind of stuff. And that for me is the one thing that I do miss about not being in the kitchen on a more regular basis, is that kind of that sort of camaraderie of a good service and you know, full restaurant and clean plates coming back, and that sort of sense of achievement, that instant gratification that you don't get when you don't cook on a regular basis.
It's also got a sense, and again, I think this is from what we see on television, what we watch in the movies, that the kitchen is kind of the midpoint of the Vietnam War. It's just this center of aggression and screaming and flying plates, and people like Gordon Ramsay, I think, perpetuate that. How accurate is that?
To a degree, there is an element of that. You know, you're working in a very pressurized environment where your deadlines are every 15 minutes. You know, every time a table orders and every time a plate of food goes across the pass, that's a deadline that you have to fulfill. And when you consider that, you know, most people don't understand how kitchens work, but you've got maybe four sections, and you've got food going to one table from four different sections, and that all has to be coordinated at the exact same time. And therein lies the pressure. So there often are kitchens where bits and pieces get thrown and there's a lot of screaming and shouting. But I think that's just the nature of the business. It's a pressurized environment that you've really got to want to be there. Otherwise, it's a hard nut to crack. So yeah, a lot of kitchens are like that. And you find that the higher up you go, the better the restaurant, and the more attention to detail, the more likely there is going to be that kind of tension in the kitchen.
I guess you've got to be able to handle that if you want to get to the top and be that sort of restaurant.
Yeah, look, I think that's the thing. You know, when you look at the top restaurants, you know, one of the hallmarks is consistency. You know, that the food is always exactly the same when you go there. And by the same, I mean the quality and the standard is exactly the same. And in order to do that, therein lies the talent. Therein lies the attention to detail and the discipline, is making sure every single plate goes out looking exactly as it should 6 nights a week. And that if you're in that sort of top echelon where you're winning awards and getting that kind of recognition, that's where God lies in the details.
Yeah, I find that my local Roadhouse at about 3 a.m. consistently on a Saturday morning, the volume of grease on the chips is just right as I wander my way home, wrapping it all in a pizza and 2 liters of Coca-Cola.
Yeah, that's it. You know, there's a discipline in that.
Eating out, you and I have talked about favorite restaurants over the years, and some of them are the kind of restaurants that sit on world top 100 lists, and others are ones that you know the chef, and it's a 206-year-old Greek woman who's been cooking forever, and you just know that it's guaranteed great, great quality. I had lunch at Core in London last week. Claire Smith, just absolutely magical, magical meal, but it's very much in a certain style of approach. Give me one of each, one of those restaurants that you're probably going to have to sell body organs, couple of children, maybe a house, and then one of those that you're reluctantly telling us because actually you'd be quite happy if nobody else ever went there ever.
Yeah. Okay, so if we look specifically in Cape Town, I would say the top of my list has to be Fane. I had an exceptional meal there recently that was just out of this world. And the service to go with it. You know, I think often we forget that it's an entire package. You know, it's from the moment you walk in to the moment you walk out and everything in between. And that was just on a whole other level. I mean, and they get recognition from it. They've just gone up 15 places on the San Pellegrino World, the restaurant, best restaurants in the world. I think they're at number 60 this year.
Yeah, that's good. Which is good
to see that they're getting the recognition. It was just an exemplary meal. I couldn't fault it. It was perfect. Then Hidden Gems, wow. That's probably a more difficult one, actually, because it's a kind of thing that I go to different places for different things. There's a great little Mexican place, for example, in Hout Bay, that do the most amazing margaritas. But there's a small little kitchen. They've got a great menu. The name's just shot out of my head now, and I go there.
It hasn't. You just don't want anybody else.
No,
to
I just
go
don't
there.
Want anyone to go there. No. But there's a little, you know. For me, you know, finding somewhere that does the perfect steak or a good curry, you know, that for me is kind of those are the sort of things I treasure and look for.
And those are things everybody has, because everybody knows where the best pizza is, but nobody's got the same answer to that question.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So we're lucky in Hout Bay, but we have Massimo's, and that is just a whole other level when it comes to pizza. It's a proper sort of chewy Neapolitan base. And for me, they're kind of pizza purists there, in that I've had times where I've had pizzas there that have been mind-blowing, that are toppings that I never would have ordered. We did a kind of a banquet sort of style where they just sent out pizzas. And I remember one that had braised fennel and confit of duck on it, which is not something I'd ever order on a pizza, but it was mind-blowing. And I think that's what I like, is that kind of inventiveness and attention to detail that's relevant no matter what level you're at. A good steak is a good steak. Good pizza is good pizza. You don't have to be in a top 10 restaurant to have a really, really good meal. Where else do I enjoy? I mean, you can't beat Peri Peri Chicken at Vasco da Gama's if you're ever going to go watch any kind of sport. The Portuguese Embassy. You know, so that you say Peri Peri Chicken, there's only one place to go in Cape Town, in my opinion. I think that's the kind of thing that I look for. That's the kind of food that excites me, you know.
I once went to a restaurant on the Algarve called Ramirez, and you've got to say it with that rolling R and a certain amount of expectoration, which was allegedly, and it's another one of these everybody knows the answer, yeah. But it's always a different answer, allegedly the home of Piri Piri chicken in Portugal.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was actually Mozambique, but according to three websites, and if it's on the internet, it must be true. And it was a tiny little place, a dusty alley in a town west of Faro, most marked out by being opposite a bottle store with a cardboard cutout of Cliff Richard standing guard at the entrance. And inside were two people. There was an ancient Portuguese grandmother dressed in black for a long departed spouse. And then there was, I assumed, her grandson, who was Manuel from Fawlty Towers, wandering around bumping into things. And we did 12 baby chickens.
Oh, wow.
And it was a table full of very loud, noisy people, including my wife. So, you know, it was very noisy. And it went absolutely quiet for about 12 minutes as we demolished these things. And that leads into the question I wanted to ask you to wrap up with. When you look back over this rollicking rock star career of yours, is there a meal, is there a food experience that, for the combination of, gee, the food was amazing, but also just the context, the moment, the memory, that surpasses the others?
Sure. It's one of those difficult questions. It's like, what is your favorite ingredient or your favorite child?
Well, that one's quite easy.
Yeah. There's been a number of standouts. There's two, I think, and they're on different sort of ends of the scale. One was in Sydney. In fact, the first time I went to Sydney, and I love about the Australians is their inventive names. I was in a restaurant in Shark Bay at the Nielsen Park kiosk, and it was literally an old tea room, but it was an Italian restaurant. And this woman who ran it, an old couple, she was famed because she used to buy in like 10 or 20 kilos of cuttlefish, fresh cuttlefish, and then scrape out the ink sacs. So, and there were like three or four chefs in Sydney who used to get a jar of fresh squid ink from her, or cuttlefish ink. And Darren, who I was with, one of the chefs, he was taking me around, and we went to introduce me. And I still remember, it was like my first or second evening in Sydney, on the first trip I ever went there. And we were just sitting, the sun was going down, and you could see across Sydney Harbour, and we had this beautiful glass of unbelievable Chardonnay from Margaret River, and this bowl of pasta that was just linguine with sautéed squid and this ink sauce. And it was one of the most heavenly dishes I've ever eaten. It was so simple, but it was perfect. And it was the setting that was perfect. And that was, for me, unbelievable. On the top end scale, I would say a meal that I had at the Gavroche a number of years ago. I was in London for about 3 or 4 days. And in fact, I had done a launch for a book, the Van de Constance cookbook that Joss Baker had written with Michelle Roux Jr. So I'd been responsible for the food for the launches. So I had been in communication with Michelle about what dishes he wanted me to do and bits and pieces and that kind of stuff. And so I was in London for a couple of days. So I took my book with me on the off chance that I would get it signed. So the publisher put me in touch with his PA, and she said to me, "So will you be joining us for lunch?" And I thought, okay, well, I might as well go. I mean, I'm in London for a couple of days. I was there for a funeral, so I had a suit. So I thought, let's go on down. And I remember going to this meal. I was quite nervous, I have to say. The restaurant, unfortunately, is gone. They closed after 57 years. It closed in January. And I remember being very, very nervous sitting in this very kind of old world, stylish kind of restaurant from another, very plush, lots of leather and velvet. And I remember looking at this menu completely daunted. Well, the only thing more daunted than me was my credit card, because this, I mean, we're talking proper money in these kind of restaurants, 2 Michelin star. And I looked through it, and then they had this tasting menu, and I kind of figured, you know, if I'm never going to come here again, or never afford to come here again. So I might as well have the tasting menu, because it's at least I'll get a good selection. And the maitre d' says, and will Monsieur be having the wines to go with it? And I thought, I'm going to be so deep in debt that I might as well, what's another £1,000?
4 million, right?
Yeah, no, it's just craziness. And this meal, was mind-blowing. It was just one of the most memorable things I've ever eaten. And my only regret was that I was on my own. So that there was no one to share it with. There was no one to go, "Mark, wow, what do you think of this taste, these textures and stuff?" And Michel came out, and he was an unbelievably gracious man. And he has this obsession with Cape Town because he's a marathon runner, and he's always wanted to run the Two Oceans Marathon. So that was interesting, and we had a long chat. And what was funny was I was standing there and sitting on this big table for one with tons of cutlery and glasses. And he was having having a little conference with the waiters, who then descended on my table, took everything away, and then relayed it. What the difference was, don't ask me. But they must have done something different. And then the sommelier, who actually was married to a South African woman. And that was great because he was obsessed with talking about South African wines and rugby, which just kind of made the afternoon a little bit more relaxing. And he said, "Well, the chefs asked us to open some special wines." So I had this meal, which for me, I think, is still to this day the meal by which all others are measured. It was perfect. I mean, when I say it was perfect, I couldn't fault a single element. There was not one thing that I went, So when we do scoring for actual cooking competitions, basically everyone starts with 100 points. So you've got 100 points to begin with, and every time you find a fault, you then take points off. So no one ever gets 100 because there's always something somewhere. But this meal was 100. It was just utterly, utterly mind-blowing in every course. And of course, now I had two wines with each course as well. So fortunately, all of the practice I do with wine and food pairing had set me in good stead to be able to still remain on my feet. I also got a tour of the kitchen to meet the other chefs, and a tour of their wine cellar. Now that was something else. And I got to hold very carefully a bottle of 1859 Chateau Yquem that was on their wine list for £25,000. So yeah, go figure. And they were one of two bottles they had, but it was just this. I arrived at 12, and I think I left at 5. You know, which is a long afternoon when you're not chatting to someone, when you're eating and drinking on your own. It was just magical. And at the end of it, I called the guy over and I said, "Look, you know, it's time to put me out of my misery. I need to go and give me the bill." And he said, "Well, no, there is no bill, so you've guested the chef." And it was like, wow. That was just kind of the cherry on the top. It was a magical afternoon anyway. But that was just made it even more memorable. Oh,
that's both a magical answer and also a deeply disappointing one, because you have, of course, dined at my house and on one particular occasion with David Higgs, yes. Where I cooked for the both of you. And it does now, when I asked you if you could score the meal and you gave me a big thumbs up and said 10, I was quite excited. I now realize you'd found 90 things wrong with the food I made for you. But I guess that's the fabric of any great career, when you're able to look back and the day-to-day weave of the tapestry, but then there are these highlights, these masterpieces.
It's funny you say that. It is true. I'm very, very fortunate to have done the traveling that I have and eating all over the world. But your reference to cooking at home, I still think some of the best meals I've ever eaten have been in people's homes.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, that lasagna you made in particular was no, that for me is because I think as a chef you get to appreciate it more. First of all, I appreciate it because people don't invite me for dinner because they find the idea of cooking for a chef quite daunting. And I say, I make roast chicken at home. Make me roast chicken. I've come to your house for mac and cheese. That doesn't bother me at all. I love the idea of sitting in front of a plate of food that I've had nothing to do with. And for me, I suppose because I'm a chef, you appreciate the effort that goes into people cooking at home. You know, everyone who just, they become used to the food that gets put before them on a table at home. They just expect it to be the standard it is, and this scant regard for the mothers, daughters, or husbands and boyfriends, what went into the shopping and the chopping. And I think as a chef, you get to appreciate that when you eat in people's homes. And for me, the difference between eating at home and eating in a restaurant is there's a lot more love in the food when you're cooking at home. You know, there's a big difference between cooking for anonymous people and cooking for people that you know and you love. There's you know, when people say you can taste the love, there's no two ways about it. You know, you're feeding people who sit around the table with you. That's very, very different from the sort of faceless people 70 of them a night that you're feeding as a professional. So it's a whole different kettle of fish, for want of a better term.
Yeah, I've never had fish out of a kettle. I'm research where that one comes from. I leave you, Pete Govwood, both with many thanks, not just for this, but for many years of great friendship, but also with an invitation, because I have been working on upping my game in the kitchen, and I've got a great new recipe for cold tripe that I think's got your name written all
over
it.
Well, I would say it's a dish that I have reference to, and it may be pretty cold and pretty nasty to live up to my previous experience.
Live down to the standards of previous ones. I suspect you've probably got a private jet heading off to a Mozambican island shortly, so I shall let you depart. But thank you, and lovely having you on the Dan Nicholls Show. You kicked it off many, 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 many years ago on television, and lovely to have you back in this format now as well.
Well, fantastic to be with you, Dan. Always, I love a bit of a chat. I still remember that first evening standing behind the curtain waiting to come on. There was no actual backstage. It was a curtain and a wall.
In fairness, that was our we were doing our dress rehearsal. We were trying to pitch it to an advertiser. We'd hired a school hall in Linden that had no electricity. You didn't really have a stage. And I think my kids had made the set. So it was very professional.
No. I remember we had to stand still because you could see us moving behind the curtain, because there was only about, there was about 10, there was about, it was one body deep behind the back curtain.
If that. Yeah. Well, we started on a low note, and I'd like to think we've stayed consistent from then.
Yeah, no, consistency has been dodgy right from the start. So it was always a fantastic program. I think that you always, what I've always liked working with you is your mix between professional and entertaining. You are able to talk some serious sports with people about getting them to relive triumphs and lows, but always, it was always fun. And I think that's what has made it incredibly watchable, was that you were seeing the human side of athletes. And too often you see these people and it's all just about the sport, and it's very, very serious, and you never really see the person behind this. And you have always been very, very good about bringing out that personality, making them seem more human, which is something I've always enjoyed.
Well, I think it's a shared philosophy. We've tried to have fun in everything we've done. And I think if you do that, you're not going to have a terribly exciting life.
It's an incredibly long time to be around if you're not enjoying it all.
Exactly. And with that apology to accountants everywhere, Pete Govwood, we look forward to having you back soon. Enjoy that Mozambican beach, and thank you.
Thank you, Dan.